Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunlap. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an interview with Reinvent Albany about the state's ongoing delay in creating a database of its multi-billion dollar economic development projects. Then for our peace segment, we talk with Mabel Leon about Grannies of Peace and their Mother's Day event. Later on, we hear a discussion about ideas on how the city of Albany might spend federal economic stimulus funds. We then talk about weather and climate change, and we end up with Jeremy Clough talking with Rachel Baxter about how COVID has impacted artists. But first, here are the headlines.
The Rensselaer County Legislature plans to opt into a New York State program that will allow 12 to 13-year-olds to hunt within the county. Children who are 12 and 13 must be under the supervision of an experienced adult hunter.
The TU reports that comments by two members of the City of Saratoga Springs School District Board questioning the need for anti-racism language in school policy is generating significant controversy. The district is considering including anti-racist language and action as one of 11 actions the district will take to disrupt and eliminate system inequalities. Several of the members prefer softer language that promotes equity.
Schenectady has a new political action committee to support Black candidates seeking elected office in the city and county. On Friday, the Schenectady Black Political Action Committee will host its inaugural event, supporting 8 candidates for local office.
The Daily Gazette reports that a woman who worked at Ellis Hospital for 30 years has sued the hospital, saying she was fired for voicing concerns about her safety at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Terry Brino is seeking $2 million in damages for her ouster, alleging discrimination and retaliation based on her disability in violation of state human rights laws.
After years of debate, the state legislature has passed a law to set minimum staffing levels at nursing homes. New York will require nursing homes to provide a daily average of 3.5 hours of nursing care per resident.
Momentum Performance Materials in Waterford will pay $2.3 million to the state to settle 14 years' worth of environmental violations by the chemical manufacturer, with more than half of the money going directly to the Waterford and Half Moon communities. The agreement allows the company to continue with this planned transition from a manufacturer of silicone to a specialty manufacturer supplying computer chip manufacturers. The facilities on Route 4 and 32 was formerly GE Silicones.
DEC has announced that it is revisiting the permit for the Lafarge cement plant in Ravenna to remove authorization to burn tires, an issue that has been the subject of several local and county laws in recent years in an effort to prevent it. Lafarge, however, can appeal the decision or apply for a new permit.
And our final headline comes from Public News Service.
A 40-year battle to close the Indian Point nuclear power plant came to an end last week as the last of its 3 reactors was permanently shut down on Friday. Indian Point was once the single largest source of electric power in the state, but its presence on the banks of the Hudson River, just 25 miles north of New York City, has long raised safety and environmental concerns. The first reactor shut down in 1974, the second just last year. Liz Moran with the New York Public Interest Research Group calls the final closure a huge victory.
This plant posed a major threat to New Yorkers, especially the over 19 million New Yorkers who live in or work in the New York metropolitan area.
Critics of the closure warn the loss of a carbon-free source of power will increase New York's reliance on natural gas at a time when the state is seeking to cut emissions from fossil fuels. but Moran points out that renewable energy sources are coming online at a rapid pace, including offshore wind farms capable of generating 4,300 megawatts of power. That's twice the capacity of Indian Point, and they're scheduled to go into operation in 2024.
There have been a number of studies that have found that this is very feasible to replace Indian Point with renewable energy. We just need the political will to do it.
New York has an ambitious plan to transition to 70% renewable energy by the end of this decade. And Moran notes the potential dangers of Indian Point and other nuclear power plants don't end when they stop producing electricity. The nuclear waste left behind will remain highly radioactive for thousands of years.
So the decommissioning of this plant is going to have to be closely monitored to make sure that it is done in a safe fashion that protects public health and protects the environment.
Decommissioning is expected to take at least 12 years and cost $2.3 billion. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Five statewide good government groups recently released a letter urging the New York State Empire State Development to finally release its database of the multimillion dollars New York awards annually for development projects. We hear from Tom Speaker of Reinvent Albany.
We're joined today by Tom Speaker, who is a policy analyst with Reinvent Albany. And they sent a letter to the Empire State Development Corporation recently, asking them what's going on with the database of deals, along with Citizens Budget Commission, Citizens Union, Common Cause, NYPIRG, and League of Women Voters. But Tom, maybe just start off, what exactly is Reinvent Albany?
So Reinvent Albany is a nonprofit organization that advocates for more transparent and accountable government in New York. We work to bring transparency to business subsidies and how the state spends money in economic development, but we also work on things such as campaign finance reform, voting reform, and the MTA.
Now, why are you concerned about this database of the state's economic development project? And why 2 years after the state allocated $500,000 to build it, is it not up and running?
So every single year, New York spends $10 billion on economic development programs. And these usually come in the form of tax breaks that go to corporations in exchange for doing business in New York State and creating jobs. And this is a substantial amount of money. $4.4 billion of it comes from the state. $5.5 billion comes from localities. And we think that there should be complete transparency on which companies are receiving this money, what types of subsidies they're receiving, and whether or not jobs are being created. And unfortunately, in many cases, we really have no idea, and it's difficult to get that information or to get much clarity about what little we do know. So that's why we've been pushing for a database that would allow New Yorkers to see that information, everything that I just listed. It's been a 6-year fight ever since investigations began into possible corruption in Governor Cuomo's Buffalo Billion scandal. It was in 2019 that the governor and the legislature agreed to allocate $500,000 to Empire State Development, which is the state's chief economic development agency, to create a database without actually requiring that the database would be built in state law. And it's been 2 years and we still have nothing. Why hasn't there been a database released yet? That I can't really answer for sure. You would have to ask Empire State Development that. The answers that they've been giving is just that it's been taking a long time to build, or that COVID-19 had slowed them down. And while we are sympathetic to some of the struggles that agency has faced due to COVID-19, we think it's been long enough in that the state should finally release the database.
Now, I remember actually working on this issue when I was executive director of the Hunger Action Network, probably started about 25 years ago, and remember developing some legislation with Assemblymember Marty Lester and this young, wet behind the ears, Assembly freshman, Scott Stringer, when he first joined the Assembly. And, you know, the big scandal was all these jobs were being promised, wasn't being delivered on. Why is it 25 years later, we're not even at a point where this basic information is still available? It seems like every few years, the legislature agrees to some type of reforms to increase oversight.
I think the reason that we don't have much transparency on this still is because if there was more transparency, it would reveal that in a lot of cases, these programs are not anywhere near as successful at creating jobs as they are touted as being. So, I mean, you gave Tesla as an example. So, yeah, the state allocated quite a large amount of money for a Tesla factory to go upstate in exchange for the company creating about 1,500 jobs. And there's been, you know, multiple investigations by reporters trying to figure out whether or not 1,500 jobs have been created. And the answer appears to be no. Tesla has kept asking for basically an extension of the deadline. And we found that you get very similar cases when you look at, just other subsidies that have gone out to companies across New York State and across the country that, you know, in exchange for however many hundreds of million dollars, they're said to create many thousands of jobs. And then when you actually look at the jobs numbers, they're often only 10 to 20%, or in some cases, 0% of what was promised.
Well, of course, you know, back in 2018 or so, you know, Elaine Calderaros, who was Cuomo's major economic development coordinator, was convicted of corruption for rigging the bid on the so-called Buffalo Billion. I think it was about $750 million. And, right before those deals went down, they had taken away the oversight of such contracts from the state controller's office. You know, didn't that conviction for corruption spur, you know, the legislature to finally crack down on these type of shenanigans?
Well, the legislature has put forth in its budgets over the past few years, or at least a few years after the scandal, proposals such as a database of deals and restoring the comptroller's power that would address some of the scandals that came to light under the Buffalo Billion program. And unfortunately, what we've seen is there's been a lot of hesitancy from the government to address these issues in law, from the governor specifically or from his administration. The comptroller's oversight powers were removed in, I believe it was 2011 or 2012. About 2 years ago, the comptroller and the governor made an agreement to restore those powers, but not in law. So the governor can basically revoke the comptroller's oversight powers over these agreements with just a few days' notice. And it's the same thing with the database of deals, that they can put up that database, but since it's not required in law, it could be taken down just as quickly. So yeah, it's been quite a struggle to get these issues to be meaningfully addressed.
So have you received any response yet from the Empire State Development or any of the legislative leaders or the governor's office to Hey, what's going on with this database?
So in response to this letter that was sent on April 30th, we have not yet received a reply. There have been times in the past where we've reached out privately to check in, and you know, we've been told it'll be shortly, or just give us a bit more time. Still, to this day, we do not have any way to get the numbers.
So we have only about a minute left. We've been talking with Tan's speaker, policy analyst for Reinvent Albany. Sort of a two-part question. You know, for the limited data you have been able to collect, how much are we actually paying per, job created with some of these deals? And, you know, what can people do at this point, both to push the state to provide more oversight, but, you know, just to sort of follow what Reinvent Albany is doing?
So it's hard to say how much we are actually providing per job. We did a review a few years ago, this was back in 2018, that if I'm recalling correctly, estimated that with the information provided through the governor's press releases, if that information was accurate, it would put it at a median of $50,000 per job. Which is pretty high, and it's unlikely that the targets that were set by the governor or that were announced by the governor were actually even being met. So we expect that the number is actually significantly higher. But yeah, going forward, our first priority is to get more transparency on these programs. And then once we have that information, seeing what can be done to either eliminate some of these subsidies or improve them so that they deliver better outcomes for taxpayers. They can find out more about our work at reinventalbany.org or on Twitter at reinventalbany.
Well, thank you, Tom Speaker, for joining us. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So 25 years ago, Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich repealed the main anti-poverty program for children from the New Deal, and that was ADC, or Aid to Dependent Children. And so the Hunger Action thought, well, why don't we look at the really big ADC program, Aid to Dependent Corporations, especially since welfare was not supposed to focus on helping people find jobs. And still 25 years later, there's a massive amount of money being distributed, and there's really no evidence that they're creating jobs with this $10 billion they give out annually to dependent corporations and welfare.
Thanks for that. For our next segment, for our Peace Bucket, Mark talks with Mabel Leon about a virtual event being held on Saturday, May 8th at 1 p.m. by Grannies for Peace, highlighting the historic role of peace on Mother's Day.
We're joined by Mabel Leon, part of our Peace segment. And she's going to talk to us about Grannies for Peace activity that they're doing for Mother's Day. So welcome, Mabel. And what's Grannies for Peace up to on Mother's Day this year?
Well, we've traditionally always done a program on Mother's Day. This is a bit different because of the virus. So this is a virtual program. And it is entitled An Appeal to All Women to Unite for Peace. And it's based upon the first Mother's Day proclamation that was written by Julia Ward Howe, that was an anti-war piece in 1870, urging all women to unite in opposition to war and violence.
So you, when you say this is the first, you know, proclamation back in 1870, was this the first proclamation that focused on the issue of peace, or was this really when we began to start celebrating Mother's Day?
It's been described to me as the first proclamation for Mother's Day, and it happens to be an anti-war plea. And so that's what we're going to make the focus of our program. And the actual, there will be a video of the actual proclamation. It's not very long. It will be read by diverse women, many of them famous women. And that little video was done by the Howard Zinn Educational Project. So we will begin with actually hearing a video of the proclamation. And then individual grannies will make that proclamation come alive in the world of today, 2021, and raise many different issues. And I can run through them. I don't know if you'd like me to do that at this point.
Oh, why don't you highlight a few?
Okay, the nuclear dilemma, Afghanistan, Iran, Yemen, climate survival, police violence, and granny love. And each of these is like a statement that a granny put together. It's an emotional plea for women to unite. And motivated by the love of our children and the love of children everywhere.
Now, when I first remember seeing Grannies of Peace, maybe 15, 20 years ago, seemed to be a lot of singing with the grannies. Are the grannies still big into singing?
That was the raging grannies. Grannies for Peace.
It's hard to keep up with all these grannies. They're everywhere.
Well, the original group in New York is the group that and we did the same action. We went to a recruiting station and asked the recruiters to recruit us. And they got arrested in New York. And finally, the judge didn't know what to do. He threw out the case. But we have done the Grannies for Peace organization does three or four actions per year. Now, the action part has been waylaid a bit by the virus. That's why this is a virtual program. And we are encouraging, we do want people not only to see the program, but to participate. And Greta Zaro from the organizing, one of the organizers of the group World Beyond War, has the technical skills and will be explaining how people can get involved. But to be able to see the program and to be able to join and participate, you have to register. And I think I'll just explain how you register. You have to Google or use whatever search engine you use and put in actionnetwork.org/grannies for peace. And the program will come up and the registration form, which will then allow you to have a Zoom connection.
Well, it is so good to see the grannies demonstrating their mastery of the internet. Now, you mentioned that, as far as you know, in 1870, Mother's Day began as sort of a call for peace. And obviously, mothers were not very happy, grannies not very happy to see their children going off and dying in war. Do other countries make stronger that connection between peace and Mother's Day as compared to what we do here in the United States, which is about, you know, buying candy and flowers?
I can't really answer that. You know, I could talk to International Women's Day, which is much more a holiday all over the world than it is here. But that has to do with it having socialist roots. But in terms of Mother's Day, I don't really know how it is celebrated in other countries. I think the call to be against war and against violence is so appropriate at this time in our world and in our country. And obviously, I mean, the nuclear issue is one that sometimes we forget about, and yet, you know, we are really threatened with nuclear annihilation. And climate survival is a massive, massive issue worldwide. And as you know, our country is extremely divided, and there is a tremendous amount of polarization. And we really have been seeing this in an event as an appeal to all women. When you get in touch with the love you feel for your children, or the love that you feel for all children in the world, that's a unifier. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want. We want women to rise above the polarization, the violence, unite together. And if we could do that, it would be powerful.
I know there's been a summit associated with A World Beyond War. And in fact, we had David Swanson, who's the executive director of that, on recently. And I know you have been upset on our last interview. We had not given you the opportunity to talk about Yemen. I did ask David about the situation in Yemen, but in the last 90 seconds, what is your concern about Yemen?
In Yemen, you have a total humanitarian crisis. I mean, I had to turn away from the TV tonight. I know that's a terrible thing to see, but say, I can't stand to look at starving children. And that's what's going on in Yemen. There is starvation going on. And it's not like we weren't part of it. We supplied the arms to the Saudis. And there has been a blockade, not allowing humanitarian aid through. And there are people dying. And what they had tonight was all these children that can't be saved. It's horrible.
We've been talking with Mabel Leon, Grandees for Peace, Mother's Day, an appeal to all women to unite for peace, and she gave us a very easy URL in order to find it. Mabel, if people want to get more involved, Grandees for Peace locally, how best they do that?
There is a website for Women Against War.
But we've been talking with Mabel Leon, Grandees for Peace, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So we did post a shorter link to the Saturday event on our SoundCloud, and presumably will be on our Facebook page once the podcast is up. This week we are having a bonus peace segment. We usually do it on Wednesday, but later this week we were talking with Nick Moten about the new Ban the Drone campaign.
And that link will also be on our website if you want to look for
it. I look forward to it.
So for those just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have questions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Paul Smart reports on a recent discussion, Paul Smart reports on a recent discussion in Albany about preliminary ideas on how the city will spend recent federal economic stimulus.
There's millions of dollars in stimulus and infrastructure funds coming from the federal government in Albany's direction. Some will go to our schools, some to the county, and a large amount to the city. How will it be spent? We weigh in on an early discussion at a recent South End collaborative meeting on Zoom, where the city's committee co-chair for these matters, Jacqueline Hoke, was the first to speak.
Jacqueline, I know that people are very curious about what you're doing. Are you in a position to tell us much today?
Good morning, everyone. We're still in a pretty much information and data drip here between the federal government and I would assume City Hall, and just like most cities across and counties, or I should say municipal organizations across the country, are just waiting to get final determination on uses and what could be done, you know, and final acknowledgement of, you know, what needs to be delivered back up the chain here. So I think that everything that we know thus far is coming at us as it comes out. And, you know, I think in terms of what has been announced is pretty much the extent of what me and the co-chair knows. We have jointly with the Mayor Sheehan, you know, developed a committee, and that should be getting confirmed and announced shortly. And to this point, that's kind of where we're at. Outside of the obvious of what the mayor said at her speech about the funds, that all remains to be the same. You know, the city is at a big deficit. So basically, in terms of the deficit that exists with the city's budget, on top of the loss of tax revenue and the loss of staff and an ability to, you know, really execute services, a large percentage of that funding will be going directly towards municipal services and making sure that the city is clean, it's being serviced by the different departments, and that the departments are in position to execute effectively. Beyond that, the budget in terms of what we can invest in and what we do is still, again, back to my initial point of understanding what the ability to use the fund and uses of funds are, that is still to be determined. So what I do know is that the mayor is really looking forward to putting this capital into communities that have been grossly affected, not just by COVID, but historical systematic oppression and racism. So the initiatives that will be coming out will have a strong focus on the core neighborhoods that obviously have been affected over the years, not just last year, and making sure that that is being done in an equitable way. Also, I just want to also reiterate, I'm sorry to cut anybody off, but, you know, I think the question was posed by Ms. Washington about the county's funding, which is also, I'm pretty sure they're in the same boat as a city, but, you know, I think there could be some understanding of what is going on with that as well. Because I think that's going to be, you know, some good, another pool of resources as, you know, the other cities and or towns in the county probably don't have the same or if not different issues that the city has. So just throwing that out there as well.
So we have Sonia Frederick here, who's a member of the city council, and also Sam Fine, a county legislator. Let's hear first from Sonia.
Yeah. Go ahead. Thank you. Yep. Everything Joaquin says is pretty spot on there. He did make an important point that the funds need to cover the losses we had from last year. And the other part of that is in addition to years going forward. So any projected losses we have, I think over the next, I think it's three or five, it's one of the two years, we're supposed to use those funds to cover. So a portion of those funds will be going towards those losses and those projections of losses. But then there is still going to be a good amount of money that's going to be invested in the community. So still a work in progress, but really looking forward to seeing those initiatives that come out of this.
Sam Fine, do you have anything that you can tell us about the county process?
And I wish I had some more information to give also on what the process is going to look like. But at this point, we still don't know yet. And I think we're still waiting for some of the details. But hopefully next week I'll be able to have some more information. But we're getting $59.25 million. It's not quite as much as the city of Albany, but still a lot of money. Some will, of course, go towards stabilizing finances, as Sonia stated will happen with the city. But I think there should be a lot of money to go towards community programs and to address the inequities that exist. Yeah, I'll just add that I think that, you know, I'd like to see the county and the city, work together on a lot of these things. There's a lot of issues there where I think they'll overlap, that it'll make sense for the county and the city to get involved. For example, housing, it could make a lot of sense to use some of that money to rehabilitate vacant and abandoned buildings, to create home ownership opportunities for people who have been left out, to make sure the community members can purchase those homes. And that's an area where the county and city right now are both have roles in. So.
Hey, Tom, I got a question.
Yes, sir.
I think it's probably, it might be for Jacqueline or Sonia or Sam. What's your confidence level that you will in fact be able to have influence, and that once again, the underserved are not going to be left out, and it's not going to be, you know, we'll get the crumbs as opposed to some of the cream?
Yeah, I'll jump on that. I think that, as you know, Rev, I'm not in the business of eating crumbs anymore, and making sure that our neighborhood is served its full entree that it deserves. And I think that from what I've been told, and from not just this conversation, because this is just the beginning, I don't think this is it, right? Like, there's a whole large group in the private sector that is carrying some responsibility, and they're actually very interested and putting their foot forward and not just leaving it on the city's dime or the city staff or the city budget. And so, more importantly, I told Kathy, I said, the biggest thing, that's missing in our city, especially, our neighborhoods, Arbor Hill, West Hill, South End, is the first money in. And historically, that first money in is the crumbs. And the crumbs can't get you anything but crumbs. And so I've also leveraged this conversation personally, and I'm just kind of speaking on my own terms. I'm not speaking in relation to this committee, but on my end, I've been pushing this ball with the private sector, the larger corporations, a couple banks, on the other end, to say, it is no longer okay for you guys to sit on the sideline and wait for the city to make the decisions. Because today, if you add it all up, it's $100+ million coming to the city. But this is a $64 billion generating, annual GDP area.
David Easton has his hands up. And
hey, yep, hello, morning everybody. Joaquin and Sam, I was curious if in both either the two different separate pools of money, if there's any sort of transparency requirement in terms of real time publishing of where money goes, or if that's in conversations in the committees and things like that. I feel like that is one great mechanism or tool to really instill trust in the process. I'm just curious if there's any mandate for that, or what the conversation currently is about, like in reference to that.
I'm not sure, but there definitely should be. I mean, there is transparency when it comes to some level of transparency when it comes to any way that government spends money, but I don't specifically know. I think we're all still waiting on the details on how this money is supposed to be spent, but I assume if in the county that it will go through the standard budget process. So the county legislature will have to, appropriate funds. I think a lot of it comes to how much of an effort we make to actually include the community in the process, because the regular budget process is, officially transparent, but I'm guessing most people don't really know what's going on. So
this has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And let's remember, this is just the most recent federal stimulus dollars. They are now debating another green infrastructure stimulus And so over the next 6 months, in fact, there'll be a lot of money going through local and county governments, and Hudson Mohawk Magazine will be following that story.
Next up, we have another episode of As the World Turns, and Dulcinea Diggs talks with weather person Hugh Johnson about climate change.
Hello, this is HM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And today, I'm speaking with retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson for another segment, As the World Turns. How are you doing today, Mr. Johnson?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I actually had a COVID shot, my second one today, and I'm doing fine so far, knock on wood.
Oh, wow. What was that like?
A quick shot in the arm, and yeah, waited for 15 minutes, and just kind of went on with life. But I felt a little lightheaded, I thought, but not a big deal. Not a big deal. I went bike riding today.
Okay. Well, seems like you're holding up all right. Okay. So now, what is some evidence that shows climate is definitely changing?
Again, the main thing is, the glacial ice caps, and not this time of year, but in the summer, they've gotten a lot less. So if you take a picture between, a Landsat picture between now and even 20 years ago, you can see how much it has shrunk. Some years a little more than others, but the trend is there. If you take the average temperature of the globe throughout the last 100 years, you can see a definite upward tick. We've risen about 1 degree Celsius since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And really, most of that has occurred since 1970-ish, but it's going up every year. And if you look at the warmest years on record globally, all but two of them have occurred since 2000. The only two that didn't were 1997 and 98, and they were involved with a super El Nino, the strongest El Nino still recorded in modern history, and that adds a little bit of warmth to the air. But anyways, the signals are as clear as they can be that we are warming. The question is, how fast will it happen and how fast can we stop it?
Okay. Now, question, how is our thermometer doing at the Albany Airport, right?
Yeah, I was afraid that you're going to ask that. I probably would have. Not good. Once in a while, I'll be excited because I'll have a temperature equal to theirs, but then an hour later, it'll be 3 degrees off. The only time that it seems that I find that it can be about the same or even warmer than me is when you have a south wind at night. Sometimes it's warmer, but most of the time, like right now, I'm 5 degrees warmer than the airport, but it's been usually 2 to 3 off, and it's really getting disturbing because I don't know what they're going to do with the climate record since this all started back in July, as I think I discussed with you, and they claimed to fix the thermometer in late October, but it may be a slightly less biased than before, but it's still not good. And I've reached out several times to the folks in the National Weather Service, and they've got their hands tied, I guess. It's frustrating. I'm so glad I don't work anymore. No. No, it's just frustrating. And it's going to, you know, it's really going to tarnish our record. And I can't tell you how it's all going to end, but I can tell you that I take my thermometer, I take people who live in Niskayuna, and people at the Pine Bush, and we're all pretty close. We're, you know, a degree or so off, and then you get the airports like this coal hole, you know, in between. So it's a problem. I don't have an answer for it. Maybe it's time for people to pick up the phone and start calling Congress, but I know we got a lot of the other things going on too.
Definitely, definitely. Man, they need to fix that thermometer already.
They do, but I need to get a one. I get a one from Walmart. That'd probably be more accurate than what they have.
Oh, geez, you're so bad, Mr. Johnson. Okay, so last but not least, how much would it cost for us to fix climate change as a whole?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question, but it's a huge answer to that. I'm going to say priceless, but I'm going to go on and say it's going to be expensive. I mean, again, think about it. Converting to electric cars is going to cost money. We're already seeing, I noticed the gas at my location close to my house has gone up 60 cents since back in the late fall, I guess. It's definitely going up, but we're going to see the cost of transition is going to be there. It's probably going to be in the millions, if not billions, or probably billions. But think of it this way, Erica. If we don't do anything about, look what happened in Texas. Look at the amount of money that's going to cost, billions of dollars. That particular disaster, that we're going to see more and more of this stuff we're going to see flooding down, you know, they got the cane tides in Miami. They already have flooding without even any storms because, again, the sea level was rising a little bit, just enough. And down Miami, a lot of things are at sea level, same thing with New Orleans. There are going to be more of these flood inundations. There's going to be massive, you know, flooding from heavy rain. There's going to be the tropical storms, the intense tropical storms. So we're going to see the price tag is going to be over 10 times higher if we don't do anything about. So as much as it's going to cost to fix, and it will cost money, and it may hurt the economy a little bit temporarily, but I think if we do it carefully and slowly, I think the Biden administration maybe has the right idea. But anyways, if we don't do anything about, it's going to be, you know, we're going to have famines, we're going to have droughts and everything else. It's going to be a lot worse. So we've got to do it. It's like pulling a tooth. You know, it's going to cost you money to pull a tooth, but if you don't do that, you're going to have many other things going on. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's only going to get worse before it gets better if we don't do something.
Absolutely.
About it. Definitely. Okay, Mr. Johnson, do you have any final words? And would you like to give out that number that people can call to complain about environmental issues?
But if you Google Governor Cuomo's office, you can get that number and you can call and say we have a climate crisis. Just keep calling. I mean, he's got other things going on in his administration now, so probably he's not going to address it. Let's just be honest. But you can Google it. Just Google Cuomo, you know, Governor Cuomo's phone number, and you will get it. I don't have it, unfortunately, at the top of my head. I wish I did. I'm not that good.
No problem. Okay, folks. Well, I just spoke with retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson for another segment of As the World Turns, and this has been HRM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs. Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson. It's a pleasure as always.
Always the same here, Erica. Have a great day.
You too.
So the governor's phone number, 518-474-8390. I should mention, though, even though the snows have not yet melted, in the mountains in California, the fire, the wildfires have already started, the earliest ever. And the last couple of years in both Pakistan and India, thousands of people have died during their annual heat wave. And with the COVID catastrophe taking place, one can just imagine how many people will be dying in the next few months when that heat wave hits.
Wow. And so our final segment tonight, Jeremy Clough continues his conversation with Rachel Baxter, creator of the recent Still Life with Gratitude mural about the impact of COVID. She also talks about her work.
I'm here in downtown Albany, not far from the waterfront, to view another example of Troy-based artist Rachel Baxter's striking artwork. This is actually on the retaining wall of the on-ramp to 787. But you may also be familiar with her work from other outdoor art displays or indoors at such venues as the Albany Center Gallery, Trader Joe's, or from her well-received pandemic mural, which toured the area earlier this spring. We turn now to an interview I conducted with the artist back in March to learn more about her work, her unique artistic materials, and her varied canvases.
The woman I spoke to at the gallery yesterday said that, this mural is actually very different from the rest of her typical work. I see, you know, the pieces that you have are, just this transformative quality of materials interacting. And almost, if I'm reading it correctly, a little bit of a almost chaotic sense.
Yes,
I see
absolutely.
Sort of organic shapes and a bit of chaos in that. And coming out of this year, which could feel rather chaotic, I'm wondering what you feel kind of compelled to create at this point.
It definitely is. It's definitely more, representational, this mural, than anything I've done in the past recent years. Very much more abstract and natural looking, very organic in the sense of like textures and movement and colors and things like that, but nothing like concrete representational. And I think with this mural, I think everyone just wants a little clarity and something they can understand and have that moment of peace. And I think I wanted that too when I was making it. I love working abstractly, and in my studio, things get messy and chaotic and crazy. And I think there's a time and place for both things, but for this mural, it was really important to me just to have that sense of control, really, and just say, I can paint this very peaceful, reflective, calming mural as my gift to my community, as a way to bring us together, as a way to heal and connect with something that's just very, very clear in its intention.
I want to look at the work that you have been doing. I'm very interested to learn about your process, the materials that you use to transform. Maybe you can give us some background of that. You use such a wide variety of materials, iron oxide and fumage.
Fumage, yeah.
Not materials you might traditionally expect from a fine artist to create with.
Absolutely. So I got my master's in fine arts at Indiana University, and I was my focus was in printmaking. So I'm a trained printmaker, screen printing, intaglio etching, a lot of kind of chemical based process in a lot of printmaking. So I kind of used that background and discovered this way of painting, if you will, although it's kind of hard to put it in that category, where I'm like oxidizing metals onto canvas or fabric to kind of pull out or let that color seep from it. So setting up steel with salt water, vinegar solutions, you're going to let that rust kind of leach out. So I'm letting like natural processes like that oxidation play a role in the color and the texture and the composition really of the work. Also doing the same thing with copper, and you get that beautiful turquoise color that kind of comes through. Fumage, which you touched upon, is actually a process where you're drawing with smoke. So kind of holding a canvas horizontally. And if you dampen it and hold candles or some sort of flame underneath it, you could actually catch the smoke in the fibers of it. And then you could either fix it or you can erase into it. It's just a really beautiful way of drawing. And all of these processes, I always find I'm drawn to them because they take control out of my hands. I get to kind of witness something that I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm very much playing a part in it. But so are these materials I'm using. So that's kind of where that body of work kind of came from and revolved around for quite some time.
I did take a detour onto your Instagram page, which is wonderful. And I saw that you had visited Iceland. And I wonder if that also, sure when that trip was, but the 2018 pieces in particular, just I saw nature, I saw a bit of chaos. But then also there was something comforting about them at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, I visited Iceland, I believe. Here's the time thing again, the time warp of the last year. I believe it was 2018. My instinct tells me it's 2019, but I feel like I'm eliminating this past year. And it just was a phenomenal trip. Just kind of seeing the forces of nature at work in that landscape, you know, really spoke to how I feel when I'm in the studio. However, it's also kind of had this very reflective impact on me, because a lot of the chemicals and things that I was using in my studio, I've put them on the shelf because I'm really trying to think about how I can create in this way, or at least in the same spirit with materials that are going to be more environmentally conscious. So I think about, you know, the spray fixative that I need to use to adhere things to the canvas, or just the raw materials that go into the practice. So all of those paintings are very much inspired by nature and the elements right at work around us. That was the impetus for the work. And now I'm starting to realize like, okay, how do I move forward with this work, but using and choosing different materials that make more sense and are in line with my values and my my environmental consciousness, I guess. So it's definitely something that I think also has been really wonderful this past year, just allowing myself that time to really, really take time to reflect and think about these things and how I want to move forward. So
interesting. So that's we're looking at moving forward. I wonder if we can briefly touch on how you got started as an artist. Was that something that you always were playing around with growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I have wonderfully supportive parents that, you know, probably had drawings on walls and driveways and every, like, just making a mess everywhere. I've always been, you know, wanting to make things with my hands. And I got my BFA in printmaking, actually here in Albany at the College of St. Rose, and continued to get my MFA at IU. It's hard to find the time where I wasn't kind of creating things. I just knew I always wanted my life to revolve around the arts. And I feel very fortunate that it does.
Wonderful. You were originally from the area?
I grew up in Stratford, Connecticut, so about 2.5 hours away from here. I moved to Albany in 2007 to pursue my BFA, and then did 3 years at Indiana, and then came back.
That's
and
good.
I just always love this region. I just feel like it's just so central to so many different things that I love. You know, the nature, we're close to New York City, close to my family, so things like that.
Troy, where you're now based, has really transformed. I remember probably around the time you moved back here in 2007, taking classes at the Arts Center. And now it's going down there, it's a whole different scene. I see a lot more public display of art, too, for art's sake. How do you feel that Troy and the Capital Region in a larger sense is maybe becoming more art-friendly?
I think people realize the power of it and how amazing it is to kind of almost orient yourself in a city based on like this giant mural you're seeing, you know. And I was fortunate enough to paint two murals in Albany. One was on a temporary like construction wall that's since been deconstructed, but one more permanent on Water Street in Columbia in downtown. And it's because of the initiative of Tony Idesico and Park Albany, the Capitol Walls, hashtag Capitol Walls project. The last few years, Tony has just fundraised and worked with a lot of different organizations to get a handful of murals up in a very short period of time. I just find it so impressive. I remember when I did my big 60, 70 foot mural on Water Street, and it was one of the very first ones. And now they're just like, they're popping up everywhere. And I just think it's so wonderful. So it makes me really happy to see it happening. And I just hope it continues to snowball and grow. And if people have walls that they want a mural on, that they reach out to local arts organizations and make it happen.
Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Jeremy Clough.
And Jeremy was talking with Rachel Baxter, creative of the Still Life with Gratitude mural.
That concludes our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice. It's supported by independent donations. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. The program is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meeting Monday nights, 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.